Today is Thursday, July 25th, 2013. This is Pauline Adams, and I am interviewing Hannah Distinguished Professor Richard Lenski at Michigan State. When I consulted the directory to see what department you were a member of, I saw several listed. And so before we start our conversation, would you please clarify for us just what department or departments here at Michigan State you are affiliated with?
So I'm in three different departments. The first department is been one that's renamed. It was the Crop and Soil Sciences Department, which now is the Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences Department. And that's in the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. And then I'm also in the College of Natural Science, split between two departments, Microbiology and Molecular Genetics, and Zoology. And that is sort of a historical set of compromises that created that complicated appointment.
Historical or political or what?
Maybe a little bit of both. Coming here as a Hannah chair, I think there was some desire to split my appointment across various units. The department that's maybe the least natural for me, given my interests, is the one in the College of Agriculture, because I really don't work in agriculture. But when I was hired, MSU had the Center for Microbial Ecology that Jim Teege and colleagues founded. And that department was housed in then the Crop and Soil Sciences Department. So that became sort of my primary home, but my physical home is in microbiology. And my many or even most of my graduate students have come in through zoology. So it's kind of, they're all very important in different ways.
That seems to be a tendency which I notice is creeping back into academia, namely the bringing together of various disciplines. I notice different universities are starting up programs now, integrating different disciplines into a separate program. And you are an example of that in your various departments.
Yeah, and in some ways it's even more than the department. It's things like the Center for Microbial Ecology, and now we have another NSF center, which is the Beacon Center, which is for studying evolution in action. And it is true that a lot of places are trying to emphasize, you know, transdisciplinarity or multi or interdisciplinary.
That's right.
But I will say that I feel like at MSU, and I've been to a lot of universities, it's one of the things that we do really, really well here. And so it's been a huge, huge part of my life here.
That's great. Because when I started here, it was in what was called the Basic College and then the University College. And at that time, the idea of general education, which was melding together several different disciplines into a general course that all freshmen had to take, was wonderful. I mean, it really was great.
Neat.
I think over the years that dissipated and disappeared, which is a shame. But you see, if you live long enough, things tend to evolve back almost.
Yes. Yep.
Well, I want to begin with your childhood, with things like your family background, where you grew up, what your childhood interests were.
Great question. So I was born in Michigan and in Ann Arbor, in fact. So my father was on the faculty in sociology at University of Michigan. And it's funny now that I have a daughter living in Ann Arbor and her husband and a granddaughter. And the granddaughter was born in the same hospital, the university hospital that I was. But at the age of about six, so I went through kindergarten and first grade in Ann Arbor. And then we moved to University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. So I really spent most of my childhood growing up in Chapel Hill. So as I said, my father, Gerhard Lenski, was a sociology professor. And my mother, like a lot of women in that era, stayed home, although she she was a very avid poet, and actually towards the end of her life had a couple of books published.
I have one of her books.
Oh, that's right. Yep, yeah, that's great. And she actually, another interesting story there is that although she actually hadn't even graduated from college, she got married while they were in college and truncated her education. She was such a good writer that when my father was writing a textbook, he relied very heavily on her for help. This is a book called Human Societies. And my father offered to make her the co-author on it, but she didn't want to in the first edition. But when she saw how much of the writing she had done when it actually came out, for the second edition and subsequent editions, as long as she lived, she was a co-author with not even a bachelor's degree. But she, in addition to helping write, actually just got deeply involved in the subject and how to research some of the topics for the book and so on.
Yeah.
So it shows that we all value the university degrees, but people with enough drive can do all kinds of things.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah. And you asked about my interests. So growing up, so I'm a biologist now, but growing up, I loved to be outdoors, but I have to say it was less as a naturalist, although I certainly loved walking in the woods and taking hikes and so on. But I just loved sports as a kid, especially baseball, and then later on tennis. So when I went off to college, I wasn't really at all committed to the sciences. I didn't know what I was going to do.
Did you play on any high school or college team?
So in high school, I played actually on a tennis team and in then summer league baseball teams, not officially the high school team, but and I loved that. And then at college, I went to Oberlin College and I ran cross country for a year or two while I was there.
Oh.
That's when I started getting into running a bit.
Great. Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask you about your college education, things like what college you attended, what your undergraduate major was, where you went to graduate school.
Yeah, so I went to Oberlin College, I had never, unlike most kids, I think, visit the university or college they go to nowadays. I just showed up with my suitcase, and it was sort of the first time living away from home. And
how did you choose Oberlin?
I chose it because it was far away from home, and it had a 50-50 sex ratio. So Oberlin, from day one, had women and African Americans, so it was very unusual place, a real trend center that way. And being 17 or whatever I was, I wanted to get far away from home, and Oberlin, among the places I applied to, was far from home. And I got there, I guess I was told when I was growing up I was kind of argumentative, and so I guess I vaguely had this idea that maybe I'd go into law or something like that. My freshman year, I took a course. It was called Government at Oberlin, and I really didn't like it. I felt that when I worked very hard with independent ideas, they weren't well received, and yet when I wrote what I thought the professor wanted, I would get the A's. And then meanwhile, I took a non-majors course for biology. And sometimes non-majors courses are dismissed as, you know, unimportant or whatever, but for me it was an eye-opener. So Oberlin College is a small place. I think the biology faculty was maybe 7 or 8 individuals, and they each taught 1 to 2 weeks of this course, and they both basically each taught about something that they were passionate about, and it was a wonderful eye-opener for me, and I immediately got hooked on biology, although I was also interested in mathematics and geology and various other things. But that was, I can't remember whether it was second semester freshman year or first semester sophomore year, but that sort of set me on the path that I continue on.
So it was the course rather than an interest you had from early childhood.
I look back and see the kind of conversations growing up in an academic family and so on, and I can also see definite connections there.
Oh.
My father, working in sociology, had a deep interest in human societies and almost of sort of an anthropological historical perspective. So there was certainly some exposure to ecology and environment that way. And my mother she'd read like Natural History magazine that had columns by Stephen Jay Gould, and she would sometimes hand those to me, and I think I'd be a little bit puzzled sometimes at them, but I was certainly exposed at an earlier age. But that course, and then subsequently wonderfully taught courses, set me on the path to biology.
So do I deduce properly that in part it's the subject matter, but in part it was the professor? The professor of government sort of turned you off, and the professors of biology turned you on.
Yeah, I would say that was very much the case. I think also it was partly the teaching and the individuals who taught it, and I think it was also finding the subject matter that appealed to me, one that, especially within the areas of biology that I study, of evolutionary biology, ecology, and to a certain extent genetics, there are just so many open questions, and I love thinking about open questions and trying to make them more precise, and how could we possibly get information about them. And so I think that scientific curiosity was somewhere in there before even that course.
Good. And a graduate school, where did you go?
So graduate school, I went back, oddly enough, to my hometown, to Chapel Hill. So I went to University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And and I didn't live at home, but I was back in my hometown. And I was in a department, then it was called zoology, now it's biology department, sort of unified biology department. And I went there. So while I was at Oberlin, despite loving the science, I discovered that, as I said a second ago, I really liked the questions, but I was a little bit intimidated sometimes by the procedures of science. So you go into a chemistry class, and you're supposed to mix this chemical with that chemical, or even in a molecular biology class, there's a lot of things you do that it's not clear where they come from, and you're dealing with equipment and substances that might or might not be toxic. And so I found them a little intimidating, whereas the courses that most appealed to me were the ones, again, like ecology and evolution, which were very question-centered and didn't have a lot of high tech behind them, or at least that's the way it was in that time. Mm-hmm. And so so when I chose biology as my major at Oberlin and went to University of North Carolina, the goal was to study ecology, because that in particular seemed like it was just full of questions. While I was there, under influences of two main professors, one my actual advisor, Nelson Harston Sr. I say senior because he has a son who works in a similar area at Cornell. But Nelson Harston Sr. was interested not just in ecology, but the interface of ecology and evolution. Okay. And while at Carolina, I also could take a course at Duke University. And there's a professor there who's now at University of Virginia named Yanis Antonovics, who was sort of almost adamant that there isn't a distinction between ecology and evolution. That sometimes people think of ecology as happening on short timescales and evolution happening on longer timescales. And in the limit, that's true. But in fact, evolution can happen very rapidly in certain circumstances. And that interplay between ecology and evolution is what really grabbed me when I was in graduate school. In graduate school, I became more aware of that particular interface and that it was so exciting.
Oh, great.
And I might say also that I had done several failed projects as a graduate student trying to find that interface.
But that's part of your learning.
That
experience.
Is part of your learning. And then the thing that ended up being my PhD dissertation, to get a successful project, I really ended up having to almost abandon the evolution side of things to focus just on a more traditional ecology project. But that only whet my appetite further I really wanted then to get into the evolutionary biology side of things.
Great, yes. So I was going to ask you next, but I think you've already answered it. Do you recall any peak experiences from that period? Experiences that affected your later professional life?
Before you put that word professional, I was going to mention it was in Chapel Hill that I met my beautiful wife, Madeline.
Oh, great.
So that was at a Halloween party. But on the professional side, it was, as I said, discovering this exciting interface between ecology and evolution. That was tremendously important. Having the failures, discovering how hard it is to do certain kinds of research. So I had been intimidated as an undergraduate by the difficulties of working in the lab and these sort of quote-unquote magic procedures that you didn't always understand where they came from. And then as a graduate student working in very basic field experiments that don't have a lot of technology, I was intimidated by how hard it is to do an experiment, a manipulative experiment in the wild, in nature. And so about a year, or really beginning maybe 2 years before I finished up my PhD, I started saying, okay, what am I going to do next? How am I going to balance these interests and these difficulties? And that's when I decided that I should go back to the lab and learn how to work with microorganisms. Even though I didn't ever have any training in microbiology, I realized that they reproduce so quickly and large populations that you can just have in small little spaces in a laboratory that maybe they would be an ideal system for studying evolution. And so after I finished my PhD, I was lucky to do a postdoc at University of Massachusetts at Amherst with Bruce Levin, who was my postdoctoral advisor. He's now at Emory University, but that's where I really got set on the kind of work that continues in my lab today.
Oh, that's great. I was going to ask about that post-university professional life, what it consisted of before you came to Michigan State, because I realize Michigan State was not your first position.
Yeah, so after finishing my PhD in 82, in the spring of 82, Madeline and I and our, at that time, son Daniel, we've got two others now, but we moved up to Amherst, Massachusetts, and that's where I did this postdoc, learning to work with microorganisms and combine microbiology with my interest in evolutionary biology. And we were there until 1985. I was worried, having been a field biologist working outdoors, that working in the lab, I wouldn't like the kind of claustrophobia of it. What was interesting, and I think so often you just have to do things to discover what one likes, but for me, I really loved the rhythm of being in a lab. There were procedures for all kinds of things, so it wasn't sort of trying to discover how to do things out in nature that nobody had done before. It was, there were very defined procedures for how to culture microorganisms, how to do certain kinds of experiments, which freed me up then to say, okay, what experiments do I really want to do?
So there was a built-in structure within which you could operate, but within that structure, you could be as free as you wanted.
Exactly. That really, you just described it exactly. I couldn't say it better. That's exactly it. And so that was from 82 to 85. And within that period, I did a sabbatical replacement as a teaching faculty member at Dartmouth. So one winter, I was still half employed as a postdoc, but I would commute up to Dartmouth and teach, like, I think it was a Tuesday, Thursday morning class. So I'd drive up early on Tuesday morning, spend two nights up in Hanover, New Hampshire, teach the class twice, and then drive back on Thursday. And that was a great experience to get some real. That was my first real teaching experience, other than as a laboratory assistant.
That's what I wanted to, I'd like to pursue for a moment. Namely, what do you see as the difference between teaching and laboratory research?
Great question. And much of what I do here at Michigan State is teaching graduate students, and also I have a number of undergraduates working in my lab. And so I would say in the best of all worlds, especially in sciences, but perhaps in other fields as well, having the two integrated is maybe the very best way to go. There's no better way to learn about science than to be working in a group that is doing science as opposed to doing laboratory exercises that echo something from the past of science. I realize you need both, but I think having these opportunities for undergraduates to work in laboratories is just phenomenal. And I tell some of the undergraduates, one of the best things they can discover is that they don't like working in a lab. And I mean that in the sense that if there's so much repetitive work in doing research in a laboratory, that if you don't like repetitive things, if you're not tolerant of that, then maybe
you belong in something else.
You belong doing something else. And so it's a great opportunity. But so many of them do just get totally hooked on it. And in working in biology, many of them want to go on to medical school, and that's fine. But one gets also very excited by the ones who start out thinking they're going to go to medical school and then say, oh, I just have the research bug and I want to stay and work as a graduate student or go on work elsewhere as a graduate student.
Do you think you could be a good teacher without the research?
I see that question sometimes in you know, discussions about education and the best ways to do it. I think I could, and I think a lot of people can do it that way. But you do need something to keep you engaged. I mean, I feel like where science education lacks excitement sometimes nowadays is the sciences have grown so large that there's so many facts that are supposed to be memorized that I think that can be a huge turnoff to many students and not really convey the nature of science. So even if one isn't a practicing scientist, I think one could be a very good teacher of science if one went back into the history of science and really talked less about what we know today and more about what were the questions people were asking in the 1700s and the 1800s and the 1900s and last century, and what are the current questions and what are the threads that connect them, and how did people have insights that allowed them to answer some of those questions, and why did answering this question set off a revolution of all these new questions that followed on the heels of those earlier questions?
So what you're describing, if I have it correct, that at first you said a few minutes ago about the vast number of facts that exist today.
Right.
Now, do you think at this point that the computer enters, that it stores those facts, makes them accessible to you, so you don't have to really know them just to be able, but you must be able to access them. Do you think that in any way frees the scientist from probing some of the questions you talk about, the past and in other words, more philosophical questions?
Yeah, that's a wonderful perspective. And I think you're absolutely right that it frees the scientist to do those. But I'm not sure it frees the student to do those unless the student knows how to dig deeply enough to really understand the connections. And many of them can explore and figure some of that out on their own. But I do think it's something that is easier for somebody who's immersed in the sciences. I think there's this quote by, I think it was Einstein, was asked some question by a reporter, and he said he didn't know the answer because he could always look that up. And so there certainly are many things that the computer does that makes a scholar and certainly a scientist able to just look up so many things that I'm embarrassed to say I haven't been over to this library for several years, because with my computer I can look up any article and find all kinds of facts and resources online. But again, for a student, I think having a teacher who is able to not just present the facts, but to tell an exciting narrative that paints a picture of where these questions came from and why they should be of interest is I think something that we don't do enough of as scientists.
And there's where some of that interdisciplinary approach comes into play.
It does, very much. I sometimes have said that if I had a chance to have a different career from the one I've had, the only one that I think would be a competitor for it based on what I know today would be the history and philosophy of science, because those are extremely interesting. I don't have any formal training and certainly not expert, but I love to delve into it.
It sounds as if that fascinates you.
It does.
Yes. Well, tell me, from Amherst You didn't come here.
No, I didn't come directly here. So then we went to the University of California at Irvine, and that was kind of a shock from the southeast, and then to the northeast, and then out to the west coast. And Irvine is one of the newer branches of the University of California, so it was very much this planned community, perfect weather every day, lived right on campus and could walk to work, and it was wonderful. And I was in a department there of ecology and evolutionary biology, and had just a terrific chairman of professor named Dick McMillan, and a lot of wonderful colleagues out there, and my first graduate students, and my first postdocs, and working with undergraduates in the lab, and teaching a lot of these large lecture courses, trying to make them interesting for the students, and it was a great 6 years before then coming here.
Now you say your movement from North Carolina up to the New England,
yep,
and then to the West Coast.
Exactly.
Each one was sort of a culture shock?
So when I went back to Chapel Hill, since that was where I grew up, that wasn't really a culture shock. New England, we loved it, but at first we were kind of put off because in the South, if you're checking out of a grocery store or meet somebody, they're always saying, you know, how are you? And a lot of small talk. And in New England, people didn't have as much small talk. So I have to say we were a little surprised, Madeline and I, that there was a little bit of a culture shock there, although we grew to love it and made lifelong friends there. And then moving out to California, it was both a culture shock, but also sort of a physical shock, just to be in a place where every day the weather was perfect. And
I remember once when we were in California and the weather was so beautiful, and some of the universities were in spots that were paradise.
Yes.
Walter, my husband, said, you know, I don't know how good the scholarship can be when you're in such a gorgeous environment. It's hard to focus on.
Yes.
Did you find any of that? No.
I didn't find it was hard for me to focus, and I don't think too many people did. And actually, you know, I think people need breaks from their work, and certainly there are all kinds of opportunities to do all kinds of interesting things. I remember, though, hearing the story that, like, the University of Hawaii would only hire people who were real lab rats. They didn't want people who would be outdoors because they would never get their work done. But
I was wondering about that. Well, what led you to choose to come to Michigan State?
So when I came to Michigan State, there's a little bit of a history behind how I got asked to apply for this HANA chair. So in the 1980s, there were sort of the rumblings of discussions and policy questions about genetically engineered organisms being released into the environment and what implications that would have. This has remained a very big topic, especially in Europe and in the context of genetically engineered or genetically modified foods. But at that time, it was a bit more focused here in the United States on some of the ecological issues. And one of the challenges was that, well, there are a lot of ecologists who don't study microorganisms and a lot of microbiologists who don't really think about ecology and evolution. And so who would be qualified to participate in some of these discussions? So although I tend to do more basic research than applied sort of things, I got dragged a bit into that line of questioning. And was involved in writing a couple of reports on that. And through those committees that I was on, one of the people I served with actually on both of those committees was Jim Teagy, a faculty member here at MSU, who then started this Center for Microbial Ecology, because he realized that there needed to be more of this interface between, you know, when we think of ecology, we think of the birds and the trees and so on. But in fact, underlying all ecosystems are the properties and the functions that microorganisms perform. And so he obtained this National Science Foundation Center for Microbial Ecology. And he asked me if I would be on the external board of advisors for that center. And I agreed. And I served for that for 1 or 2 years. And I guess I was sort of a loudmouth saying, well, you need more of this and more of that. And they had, because they had been successful in getting this NSF center, the university administration rewarded them with some open positions, one of which was this Hannah chair. And then Jim Teagee and some of his colleagues asked me if I would apply for that. And I was very junior to be considered for an endowed chair and flattered to have been asked to apply for it. So I did. And I was lucky to get it. And
Can you point to any specific peak high points in your professional career here?
So special high points here. So I always think of what we've been doing lately. So even some unpublished work, there's so much exciting stuff going on. So one of the highlights, I guess, of my career, one of the things that my lab and I are well known for is this experiment that's actually been going on for 25 years. So it started out in California and has continued for most of its time here at MSU, where we've been just doing a very simple experiment of watching 12 populations of bacteria evolve in the laboratory. They all started out the same. They're all in flasks that are identical and just inches apart from one another in the incubator, and we're asking the question, how reproducible is evolution? If you have random mutations that, as I said, are random spontaneous events, but then you have natural selection systematically favoring certain properties over others, how predictable or unpredictable will evolution be? And it wasn't really intended to be a 25-year experiment. I didn't really know how long it would go, but I joke that it's the experiment that just keeps on giving. There are just so many exciting things that keep popping out of it. So that would be one, I guess, highlight, but it's sort of a slow motion highlight because every phase it's been exciting.
Slow motion highlights are preferable because they're long lasting.
They're long lasting, that's right. And the other thing that has just been incredibly exciting and rewarding, maybe two other things. So on the research front, another area that got me incredibly excited was the idea that one could study evolution not even in a biological system, but in a computational world. So through Wolfgang Bauer, who till recently was the chair of physics, he and I played over at the athletic club in a squash league. And he told me that he had a colleague who was going to be giving a seminar in his department, and would I like to hear. And the seminar was titled something like Self-Organized Criticality in Artificial Life. And I think I kind of rolled my eyes. It sounded kind of a little BS-y to me. But I went to the seminar. It was given by a guy named Chris Adami. And it fascinated me because so much of his data on what it is it's computer programs, like computer viruses in a way, but not intended as malicious agents, that make copies of themselves, but they mutate and compete with one another. And this was just so exciting. And so I began a collaboration with Chris Adami, who at that time was at Caltech. Just last year, we hired him at MSU. This generated what is this second NSF center. We have this one beacon for the study of evolution in action. We're working with all kinds of biologists and all kinds of engineers and computer scientists are looking at evolution sort of as broadly as we can, but with an emphasis not on looking at the historical record of evolution, but looking at evolution as an ongoing process and one that can be done not only in biological systems like with our bacteria, but that can be studied in artificial, seemingly non-living systems, but that actually have the properties of life, the ability to mutate, to compete with one another, and so on.
So you can actually observe it in process.
You can observe it in process. So that the key words there are the evolution in action, or real-time evolution, sometimes people call it. And that's just, that's sort of been my, that's been what my career has focused on. And then the third highlight, I would say, and again, this is a slow motion one, which makes it all the more pleasurable, as you said, is the graduate students and postdocs and undergraduates who've come through the lab and the successes that they've had in their careers have just really been extraordinary. And just this morning I got an email from a former postdoc who said, oh, I just went from associate professor to professor. And anyhow, these things, you just love to see young people succeed and...
These young people, do they come from all over the country, all over the world?
In my lab over the years, I would say almost all of the graduate students who've come through my group have been from the United States. A couple of exceptions, at least one from Canada and so on, but almost all U.S. But from as graduate students, maybe a little preponderance from Michigan, but pretty much all over the United States. Postdocs come from all over the world. Most of them have come from the U.S., but I've had outstanding postdocs from Mexico and Poland and Spain and Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And Canada, and I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple of other places.
France.
Too. I have not had a postdoc from France.
That's ironic.
It is a little ironic. One of my best collaborators is a professor at Grenoble named Dominique Schneider. So I do have a lot of connections over in France, and as you know, Madeline and I and our kids spent a sabbatical year in Montpellier, and that was wonderful. But I think I have not had a student or a postdoc from France.
Interesting. Well, you've given me lots of high points. I wonder, what were the low points?
Low points. Good question. I don't tend to dwell on those too much. I mean, there have been a couple of temptations. I mean, when Madeline and I moved to East Lansing, we sort of thought this might be a way station. Her family's from upstate New York, and mine was in North Carolina. So we sort of thought we might only be here a few years, and then some other opportunity would come up. But between the place to live and having neighbors like yourself, and the university being so supportive, there have been a couple of temptations, but.
I was going to ask you about those temptations.
But I really can't point to a low point. I'm sure there have been a few. I mean, every scientist has, you take getting, experiments go wrong all the time, but sometimes it can be frustrating to get papers and grants rejected. And so certainly those must be among the low points. But by the time you've done it for a while, this is just part of it, and you learn to just go with the punches. There are many other opportunities, and you try to avail yourself of those. On the other hand, you do see when graduate students, for example, getting their first paper rejected, they can, and especially if it feels like it hasn't been fairly reviewed, they said, but we did say this, and the reviewer clearly hadn't read things very carefully. So I do save a file of some of the worst rejections I've ever had. And when a grad student is particularly dismayed, I'll bring out a review in particular of this first paper we ever wrote on this long-term experiment that continues for 25 years, where I can still quote some of the negative aspects of that review. And the students are so relieved to see that even good work sometimes has
good teaching.
Negative reviews. It's a teaching moment. And a life moment.
Right. Well, you seem to have a very optimistic nature, a very upbeat personality. And so your low points clearly in your mind are not low, not very low.
Yeah, or they're not very lasting at least.
And not lasting. And I know that you have received many attractive offers from other universities since coming here. But you chose to remain. Why?
The superb colleagues and this, going back to something we talked about at the very beginning, many universities want interdisciplinary research, but at MSU, but they often don't quite know how to do it. And it's not even that the university should know how to do it. It's up to the individual faculty to have that feeling that they want to do it. And here at MSU, the barriers to that have been low, and the colleagues have been extremely interested in doing it. And so the last temptation one a few years ago was just as we were in the running for this Beacon Center for the Study of Evolution in Action. And I remember sort of thinking that on top of the fact that I didn't really want to leave, I like MSU too much, that, oh man, to leave this thing just as it's getting off the ground, or it wasn't even funded there, maybe that would hurt its chances. It just didn't feel right. So
you chose to stay.
I chose to stay. I do tell sometimes, this might sound a little bit funny, but I've been involved in a lot of recruiting efforts to bring faculty to MSU. And sometimes I make the joke that East Lansing's a nice place to live, but you wouldn't want to visit here. And by that, I mean, you know, we're in the Midwest. It's not New York City. It's not California. It's not France. It's flat. The weather's not always perfect, although today, as we discussed, coming in is a perfect Michigan summer day. But as academics, we get to travel. We go to meetings, we go to conferences, we go get seminar invitations, we can take sabbaticals, we can run our schedules pretty much within reason how we like. And so being in a place where people are friendly, where you can afford to buy a house, I also joke that we're having a buy one, get one free sale. these are things that, and great schools. So in the neighborhood where we both live, our kids could walk to elementary, middle, and high school. How many people nowadays can say that their kids could walk to all the public schools and have a great education, great friends?
Yeah. So, and you don't regret your choice?
No, I don't regret the choice at all.
Now, I'm also aware that you have received much recognition for your work beyond Michigan State. And I don't want you to be embarrassed, but could you please tell us about some of these?
Let's see. I mean, the Hannah Chair, getting offered that, and especially when I was young, I think it was a gamble by MSU. Because if you look at my track record, it was fine up to that point, but that was really the first, major honor. Another one that got a lot of attention was one of these MacArthur Awards, and that one that just comes as a phone call out of the blue and comes with a significant pot of money. And I remember Madeline was out of town when I got that, and we were talking by phone, and we had been speaking for about 20 minutes, and she had actually just been visiting with Daniel, prospective, our eldest, our son Daniel, been visiting a prospective university, although it wasn't a formal visit because he was still a couple of years away from it. And I said, oh, by the way, I think we can afford to pay tuition at this place now, because earlier today, so I left it to the end of the conversation, just kind of, I don't know, it was just sort of fun to do, to spring that surprise that way on her. So, and that also came at a very opportune time, not only in terms of the upcoming university expenses for the kids, but also it really set up the opportunity to take the family to France on this sabbatical, and just totally relieved us of the worries of kind of, you know, can we rent the house? And I don't know, just the other things like that. And so we were able to take the whole family over and travel. And
you've gotten more. Yeah.
And then I guess the two other awards that I could mention. One is perhaps the other most visible one is the National Academy of Sciences. And about the only thing I can say about that is that being now on the inside of the process, I realize just what luck is involved, because there are capped numbers of people in the National Academy of Sciences. And there are so many deserving people in every field of study, certainly the ones I know about, that it's other than the fact that somebody has to get in, it's not always clear why one person gets in and other people so deserving just never get in.
That's humbling to learn.
It is humbling. It is humbling to learn. The other thing that's slightly humbling about that experience is after the shock of the and the wonderful experience, there's a neat inauguration where after you're elected the next year, you go to the annual meeting and you walk across stage and you sign this book that the National Academy of Sciences was started by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. And so you sign this book that has been signed by all the members of the National Academy going back to, I think, 1863. And then there's a party. There's a lot of scientific business, but there's a party that we go to every year that Madeline really loves. And then this past spring, I had an honor, which was an honorary degree from the University of Wageningen in the Netherlands. And that was a special honor because I was put up for that honorary degree by a former postdoc, Arjan de Visser. And he and his colleagues pulled it off, and they had a day-long symposium talking focusing on this field that we call it experimental evolution, studying evolution in action in real time. So day-long symposium, got to wear the gowns and wander through the streets of Wageningen. It was sort of a mixture of snow and rain, so we were holding our umbrellas except when they were taking pictures. And it was just, that was a very fun occasion. And again, because it's from somebody, a former lab member, that held special pleasure.
I think that's wonderful. I want to congratulate you on always. I would like, we would be interested in hearing what you see the role of higher education in American society is.
Oh, boy. I'm not sure I'm really good at these.
An easy question.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm good at these wide open questions. So I think there are so many roles, from civil discourse, how to talk about the issues that face the country and the world, to the engines of economic growth. So certainly science has played a huge role. I mean, one of the areas I worry about that's a little closer to home is the push to make science more applied and practical. This is happening in the United States and around the world. And I think that the politicians don't always understand that science rarely starts out answering these applied questions. It's usually curiosity driven. And this goes back to the discussions, and this is why it's higher education's role, because this is part of the way we should teach science, is where did these ideas come from that have been the engines for scientific progress, which in turn have allowed corporations and business people to harvest, in some sense, those discoveries and use them to improve health and make money and so on. But very rarely is the really foundational work in a field growing out of those applications, I think. And so somehow, as a university, we need to convey that, on the one hand, as I said, to students in our training, but also to the general public and to university administrators. I worry a tiny bit about it. I mean, I think MSU is particularly vulnerable to some of these issues. I mean, we have the historical land-grant mission with agriculture, which has been extremely successful, but with agriculture, some of the changes in agriculture, and with so much of the money in science now, at least in biology, the biological side of sciences, going to funding medical research, which has not historically been MSU's mission. Should a university like MSU try to glom on as a relatively small player to some of these areas where places that have long traditions of medical research are in front of us, or should we try to find ways to maintain our strength in the basic sciences, in agricultural sciences, and so on? So those are just a few rambling thoughts. And then, of course, I mean, I mentioned the civil discourse, although I'm sort of, as you can tell, obsessed with thinking about science, the university's mission so clearly covers the humanities, the social sciences, the arts. And again, there's a tendency to downvalue those because they don't bring the big bucks to the university. And we have to find a way, both at the individual university like MSU, but in the society as a whole, to value all of those things and think about the long term, not just the next checks that are coming in.
Do you think that short-term vision has sort of taken over the world?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think that's a recent development, or do you think this has almost always been true?
I suspect it's probably always been true, but maybe impacting different aspects of life. So certainly, you know, our ancestors, hundreds and thousands and 10,000s and hundreds of thousands of years ago, had to worry about where the next meal was coming. So talk about short-term thinking. That's, as biological organisms, survival and reproduction are short-term goals in some sense. Maybe reproduction not. I mean, especially with humans, that's one of the things that sets us apart, is that we do invest in our children for such long periods of development. That's quite unusual. So there's always been that press. But I guess my sense is that that universities have moved in terms of, again, the higher education aspect. The emphasis on budgetary issues has grown. The amount of, I think I've read, and I think my father may have pointed it out to me, that something like from when he first became a faculty member to now, that the ratio of administrators to faculty has increased by an order of magnitude. Some of those undoubtedly are necessary for certain initiatives, for certain government mandates, but I think a lot of it is also an effort to pull in and deal with budgetary problems. And the degree to which states support, I mean, here we are, a state university, and I'm sure you have the figures, I don't have them, but the fraction of a state university's budget that comes from the state has been in steady decline at all of the leading state universities around the nation.
It's almost difficult to think of the University of Michigan or Michigan State as state universities these days, because such a small fraction of their budget comes from state.
Yes.
And when we first came to Michigan State in 1947, nearly all of the budget was from the state.
Yeah.
And in my own lifetime, I've seen an enormous shift on that very issue.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. I won't name the state, but I had a colleague say something like that he thought that if the state didn't own the buildings and the land, that the university he's at was sufficiently frustrated with the low funding and especially the political meddling that can be imposed, that, you know, they would really like to be a private university and just get the state off their back, but because states own the land and so on. So, but, you know, there's so many competing demands in the world. I don't see an easy solution, at least over the short term, but I think if we can manage to look long term through this process of civil discourse, that hopefully we can find a healthier balance than I think exists right now.
I was going to ask you if you would like to see any changes at Michigan State that might enable it to better fulfill the role you envision of the university. And I'm not sure if you haven't already answered it by alluding to what you see as a major financial problem that has led to a change, really, in the university structure.
Maybe one concrete wish or suggestion is, so I'm very fortunate. I'm in the newest science building on campus, the BPS, Biomedical and Physical Sciences Building, which is sort of it's a little bit of a hodgepodge of three different departments that were all strong departments that were in very old buildings. And so it was desperately needed. But they're actually, certainly in the sciences and perhaps outside the sciences, but in the sciences, so many of the buildings at MSU are, I hesitate to use this word, but I think decrepit is the right word. And it really impedes our ability sometimes to attract the best faculty, to get the best funding, to get the best graduate students. And it's a serious need in the sciences to have reasonably modern lab space in order to function. And I feel like we're getting close to a danger area in, again, not the building that I'm in, but many of the buildings on campus. Huge amounts of money are spent renovating a lab for new faculty members, but that's done a very piecemeal, and again, not thinking long range about the best way to improve the space. But again, that's sort of a parochial comment from my perspective as a scientist.
Well, but that's something you've observed.
Yes.
And you've experienced here, and that you're afraid will discourage other people from coming here.
Yes.
And certainly I think that's an important point to make. Is there anything else you would like to discuss about your work, about Michigan State, or the world of education, or science in general? I give you carte blanche to just add anything that might be of interest to you.
I don't think I have anything, because you've touched on so many important issues, way more than I imagined that we could talk about in a relatively short interview. I would just say again, I think that MSU does so many things extremely well, the interdisciplinarity in particular, and the collegiality that extends to the neighborhood we live in, the departments that I'm a member of, the interdisciplinary programs, the student-faculty relations, I think are excellent, especially among, certainly among the graduate students and the faculty that I interact with, and especially maybe with that subgroup of undergraduates who really take advantage of the fact that this is a research-intensive university. It can be no doubt intimidating for an incoming student at MSU to sit in these classes with 300 or 400 students, but for those who seek out opportunities, and unfortunately there aren't enough, I mean there's a limit to how many people can work in a lab, but some of our best students are as good as any student anywhere in the world, and many of them certainly in the sciences, and I'm sure in the arts and humanities, find ways to get involved in the life of scholarship. And that's something MSU does very well.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing with us your experiences and your insights.
Thank you very much, Pauline.